is a Yahoo Finance special remembering 9/11 20 years later, the terrorist attacks that shook the world and changed our lives forever. The unbearable pain of that terrible day, still real and present 2 decades later.
This 20th anniversary of 9/11, it's an affirmation of our beliefs. And with the events in Afghanistan, it takes a more profound effect.
Today, we pay tribute to the lives we lost, celebrate their spirit, their enduring legacy. We'll honor the heroes, their strength, their courage. We'll look forward to the continued renewal and rebirth and hope for the future. Also, the mission of the National September 11th Memorial and Museum.
And we're in the middle of a transition from memory to history.
Join us now for this Yahoo Finance special, Remembering 9/11, 20 years later.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Alexis Christophorus, live at the 9/11 Memorial Pool here at the World Trade Center site in New York City on the eve of the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Over the next 90 minutes, we are going to honor the lives lost on that fateful day and also remember all of those who have worked so hard to keep their memories alive. Right behind me here, like I said, is the memorial pool, and activity is a little more than usual as people start to gather for the 20th anniversary. I was able to speak to a number of people, some people coming away from as far away as Florida, some folks from Maryland who had no real connection to what happened here that day. I also spoke to some family members who came, who had victims in those towers, and I even spoke to one man who was in the North Tower when it was hit. He told me he was on the 84th floor and had about 10 minutes to get out. He now still lives in New York State, and he came here today to remember his 60 fellow colleagues who he lost on that day. We know that a number of first responders were lost that day as well. And in just a moment, we are going to be hearing behind me here the NYPD, Port Authority Police, and New Jersey State Police. They are with the Emerald Society Pipe and Drum. They come here every year on 9/11 to play and to remember their brothers and sisters who were fallen. And I want to begin today's special with one of the first responders who answered the call that day, and that is the retired Assistant Fire Chief Joseph Pfeiffer. Chief Pfeiffer was the first battalion chief to arrive on the scene that day. He ran into the North Tower and immediately set up a command center to begin the rescue mission. And I am so glad that we have the chief here with us today. Chief Pfeiffer, it is so good to see you here. When you think back and reflect on what happened here 20 years ago, I wonder if there is an image or a memory that sticks out to you. And I'm wondering if this being the 20th anniversary seems different somehow.
There's many images that I think about when I think of 20 years ago. But the one image that sticks in my mind is as the first responders, our firefighters, police officers, EMTs, and paramedics responded that day, they looked at the burning towers, and they knew they were going into the most dangerous fire of their lives. And they came in quietly and came up to me and said, "Chief, what do you need?"
Yes, we've heard so many times before that when others were running from these buildings, they were fleeing. The good firefighters of this city were running into those buildings to save lives. And 343 FDNY members were lost on 9/11, including your brother, Kevin. Can you tell us, Chief, what your last exchange was with your brother, and how are you keeping his memory alive?
A little bit before 9 o'clock, my brother reported into me in the lobby of the North Tower, and he didn't say a word. We looked at each other, wondering if we're both going to be okay. And then I ordered him, as I did many other fire officers, to take their unit and go up to evacuate the building and to rescue those that couldn't get out. And when my brother Kevin turned around and brought his firefighters, Engine 33, upstairs, that was the last time I saw my brother Kevin and Engine 33. But I keep those memories alive on each anniversary. When I take the memories of my brother from my heart and I think about that day when I saw him in the lobby. So we had a very special moment 20 years ago that I'm very grateful for. And it's wonderful hearing the bagpipes behind you play as I talk about my brother Kevin.
Yes, Chief, it is quite appropriate. And I have to tell you, it's quite a sight to see and hear down here at the site of the World Trade Center. A number of people have gathered now as the officers play their pipes and drums. Again, it is police officers with the NYPD, Port Authority, and New Jersey State Police. Chief, on that day, you had to make a lot of split-second decisions. There was no playbook on how to do this, and it impacted a lot of lives. What did you learn about leadership and managing through a crisis from that day that you've kept with you?
Making the decisions during this time was a combination of intuitive thinking to be able to move quickly, but also what I call deliberate thinking. So when the South Tower collapsed, the North Tower lobby went completely black, and we had no idea that the noise, the rumbling noise that we heard was what people saw on TV, a collapse of a skyscraper. And I took less than a minute to think, what do I need to do now? Yes, we can't command in this darkness. And if we can't command, then I need to get my firefighters out. And I got on the radio and I said, command to all units in Tower 1, evacuate the building. And our firefighters came down. But they did some ordinary things that day. As they were coming down, they helped people down the stairs.
Tell everybody what we're seeing right now. And these are the police officers of the NYPD and the Port Authority and the New Jersey State Police. They do this every year. They come down. They said it's a tradition. And they say that this year holds even more significance when you think about the events that are unfolding in Afghanistan, when you think about we as a world are going through a pandemic. Many people I spoke to down here today said that this year is a little more difficult. It feels a little different. Chief, I'm wondering if you're feeling the same thing, and how can we think back to the aftermath of 9/11 when we saw so much unity across the world, people coming together. What can we take from then that can help us now during these trying times?
I think the 20th anniversary, there's so much interest because 20 years ago, on September 12th, we felt, as you mentioned, the sense of unity, both nationally and internationally, that we're in this together. So as we meet new challenges, whether it's terrorist events, whether it's a pandemic or climate change, I think we need to grab that feeling we had 20 years ago when we felt this sense of unity and that we can tackle even the most horrendous things like the collapse of the World Trade Center. We can do this together. And that's what we have to take today so we can deal with tomorrow's challenges.
It's a positive message, an important one. Chief Pfeiffer, thanks so much. We appreciate it. And be well.
Thank you.
And I also want to bring to your attention that the chief has written a memoir. It is called Ordinary Heroes, and there certainly were a lot of them here on that day 20 years ago. Ordinary people rising to the occasion to do extraordinary things. Do stay with us. More of Yahoo Finance Live to come, live from the World Trade Center site. Coming up next, I'll be joined by a documentary filmmaker who tells the story of one hero of 9/11, Wells Crowther.
I remember I had just dropped my daughter off at school. I was in Manhattan and I was walking down 6th Avenue and someone called me and told me a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center and I could look down the avenue and see smoke coming out of the tower. I walked into the Time Life building and we found out what was going on. I started getting emails with names and subject lines, and some of people I know were killed. including a good friend of mine from college who was in one of the planes. 1 week after 9/11, I was working for CNN at the time, and the New York Stock Exchange was going to open back up. The smoke was still coming out of the ruin, and we opened up the New York Stock Exchange with Lou on the floor and Paul and I on the roof of Phi Penn Plaza. And I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that moment of excitement, sadness, but also rebirth and a new beginning.
Welcome back to this Yahoo Finance Live special on the eve of the anniversary of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. We are here at the memorial site right now, and there are a number of people who have gathered as we have police officers from New York and New Jersey about to play as part of an annual tradition, the Fife and Drum Band, the Emerald Fife and Drum Band, come down here to remember all of their brothers and sisters who they lost on 9/11. You know, you don't have to go very far to find the heroes of that day, like the man in the red bandana. Wells Crowther saved at least 10 people from the burning South Tower, but tragically couldn't save himself. His story is documented in a film by Matthew Weiss, who actually wasn't a filmmaker at all, but a career attorney, when he was inspired to turn Wells' story into a film.
I never made a film before. I never read a book on filmmaking. I actually never took a class in filmmaking or had a bucket list dream of making a film. But I went to lunch with my banker, Jeff Crowther, and I just started using his bank for my law firm. And over lunch, he told me this story about his son, Wells, and I was just blown away. I literally thought it was one of the most amazing stories I'd ever heard. And in quick succession, I said to myself, everyone needs to hear the story. I want to share the story with everyone. So while there are filmmakers that look for stories, this was a story that found the filmmaker.
Let's talk more about Wells and what a special, special man he was. For those who are not familiar or who have not seen the film, he had multiple times where he could have gotten out and saved himself, but he went back in, and that was not his job that day. He was not a firefighter, although I understand he's one of the few to be posthumously given the honorable firefighter title. That's something that he wanted to do at some point in his life, was to become a firefighter. But tell people about Wells and what he did that day.
So Wells was 24. He worked on the 104th floor of the South Tower. He was an equities trader for a company called Sandler and O'Neill Partners. And after the first building got hit, which was the North Tower, he called his college roommate and told him he was going to get out. And then his building got struck minutes later. And so he left a voicemail for his mom, and she said that he was okay. And that was the last that they heard from him. And so 8 months passed where they had a memorial service, and then they located his body in the lobby, and then they had a private funeral service. And then in May of 2002, so now we're 8 months past 9/11, there was a New York Times article with survivors and what they saw, how they got out. And Allison, who never gave up looking for her son, anything, any information about him, read this article. And in there were two women who both said that they were led up and out by a man who had a red bandana over his face. And as soon as she read that, she knew that was Wells, because he always carried a red bandana. It was a habit he got into. His friends would tease him about it, but he had it. He played lacrosse. He had it under his helmet. He used it to wipe up spills. And it was just his little thing that he had. And so she sent photos to both the women, Ling Young and Judy Ween, who positively ID'd Wells as the man that saved them both, and then met with these women. And through their accounts, the Crowthers were able to piece together the last hour of their son's life, his finest hour. He put out fires on the 70th floor, which was the sky lobby where the United Airlines plane struck. He extricated people that were trapped. And then he led a group down from 78 to 61, carrying a woman on his shoulders. He left that group in clean air and safety and went back up, led another group down, went about five flights, went back up a third time, and let yet others out. In my research, I have found, I believe, 10 people that he saved on that day. 10 people who were in the upper reaches, who were at or above where the plane hit. So statistically, we're likely to die. Only 18 people survived at or above where the plane struck the South Tower, and Wells saved at least 10 of those 18 people.
It's absolutely incredible, the selflessness that was on display that day. And I know that Wells, unfortunately, was in the lobby of the South Tower when the building collapsed, and he did not survive. And that red bandana that you speak of, I know is on display. I've seen it at the 9/11 Museum. What do you believe is Wells's legacy?
Well, so you mentioned the lobby, which is important. His body was found in the lobby, and his family and friends were frustrated. Like, why didn't he get out? He was only a few feet from safety, a few hundred feet. And then they found out he was with a group of firefighters that had just called in that they were going up to 78 with the jaws of life to help people up there. So they realized very quickly that Wells was actually going back up a fourth time with this firefighter group to help yet other people. So he certainly could have saved himself that day, and he chose to give his life to help others. And that's why he was bestowed the honor of being a New York City honorary firefighter.
What do you believe should be his legacy when people think of and hear the name Wells Crowther?
I think someone of who's selflessness, caring, heroic, courageous. Those are the values that Wells personifies. I made my film, and I was passionate sharing this story because I wanted to encourage others to just think a little bit less about themselves, a little bit more about others. It could be as simple as giving up your seat on the subway or bus, or holding a door open for someone who's coming in the same building as you. Just doing little acts of kindness, and there's all ways that we can improve ourselves. And I felt Wells' story was such a sterling example of that.
For sure. Are there other ways, in addition to this film that you've made, that you are helping to keep his memory and legacy alive and what happened on that day 20 years ago?
Yeah, I'm always sharing Wells' story. I'm speaking tonight in Chicago about Wells, and I'm speaking in Fort Lauderdale on Saturday night about Wells. I continue to maintain my Facebook page. We have like 15,000 fans, followers that get updated about things. You know, there's different events where people honor Wells, and we post photos of that. And I feel like I'll be spending the rest of my life sharing Wells' story and his values to as many people that will listen.
You never met, obviously, Wells Crowthers, yet he has become a pretty big part of your life, Matt. If you were able to say something to him, what would it be?
I love you.
Yeah.
just incredible. He was, captain of his hockey team, always thought of others first. This was not surprising to his friends and family when they found out what he did that day. Needless to say, what I think is truly amazing about the story is that a piece of fabric, this bandana, changed the perspective on his family and friends' feelings about the loss. Obviously, it didn't take away their pain, but it allowed them to manage their pain, give them some direction and some pride in the fact that he had free will, that he used his last hour in a selfless manner. He was courageous. And certainly when you lose someone and you don't know what happened, and then you find out these amazing qualities that he displayed in his last hour, it certainly shifts your perspective. And all 8 months after the fact. So I just think it's just an incredible story on many accounts.
And our thanks to Matthew Weiss for bringing us Wells Crowther's story. By the way, you can catch the remastered version of the documentary Man in Red Bandana streaming now on Amazon Prime. You are continuing to hear the Fife and Drums Emerald Society play. They are the NYPD, Port Authority Police, and New Jersey State Police playing. Just a few moments ago, they played God Bless America and a beautiful rendition of Amazing Grace. It's something they come down to this site to do every year. We're going to have much more Yahoo Finance Live to come right after this. More than 800 children lost a parent who was a first responder here on 9/11. And just 3 months after the attacks, the First Responders Children's Foundation was created to provide scholarships and other financial assistance to those victims' families. With me now is the foundation's president, Jillian Crane. Jillian, thanks so much for being with us. Talk to me a little bit about how the mission of the foundation has evolved over the past two decades.
Thank you very much for having the foundation here today. And basically, we have been a scholarship, pretty much focused on scholarships for first responders who've been killed or injured in the line of duty. And when COVID-19 happened, we pivoted immediately. We decided that we should focus on the firefighters around the country who are volunteer and who have lost their jobs and who are EMTs and paramedics and ambulance drivers. And we actually expanded our mission to include nurses and medical personnel and home health care workers. And we provided them with a COVID-19 financial hardship grant, which was really, I think, a safety net for many people. We provided 13,000 hotel room nights with food stipends so they wouldn't have to go home and infect their families. And as you know, it was really a lot of anxiety for children in this country, but the children of first responders had a lot more of that because their parents were going out into a world. They didn't know if they were coming home. They didn't know if they would bring home COVID-19 to the family. And we ended up, sadly, having to pay for funerals, and we started a bereavement fund and emotional support. We started a mental health grant that has been really important, and I think important going forward for first responder families.
Absolutely. Such important and special work that you're doing. Tell me how you're finding the funds. Where are you finding the funds to do all of this?
I'm so glad you brought that up because, you know, this is the 20th anniversary of 9/11, but it's still happening for those who, number one, are suffering from 9/11 related illnesses. 75% of the FDNY is affected, and they're unfortunately very sick or have died from that. And also, all over the country, we can now really highlight the work that first responders are doing in every community because we need to support them and we do need to find more funds so that we can continue to be able to pivot and give first responders and their families what they need when there are, as we know, hurricanes and fires and pandemics and things for the first responders to respond to in every community in this country.
It feels like we're getting hit with all of it right now. I know that many of the children you helped years ago are now grown up, they're adults, and some of them have actually followed in their parents' footsteps and become first responders themselves. I'm curious if they stay involved with the foundation, or do you stay in touch with them?
I just received a letter last night. Actually, it's so funny you ask, and I opened it. It was just a thank you for helping someone get through their college, and that person has now become a nurse. So nurses, firefighters, criminal justice, police, what I've noticed this year, we gave the scholarships out. By the way, more than 200 scholarships, $600,000 this year.
Wow.
And we have so many more students. We're in 40 states this year with our scholarships, and we really see the need. And I think what's amazing about these children is that they are resilient and that they care about their communities and they want to follow in their parents' footsteps. And we look at the first responder not just as a unit, a single unit, but that the whole family sacrifices on a daily basis if their first responder is a parent.
How can someone find out if they're eligible for some assistance and for these scholarships? And also, how can people help the fund?
Please go to first1strcf.org and come to our website, or text 24365 to scholarship. So text scholarship to 24365. And we say that because first responders run into danger for us 365 days a year.
Goodness knows they do. And just for you personally, being here on this 20th anniversary, a lot of people think it's a milestone and maybe there should be bells and whistles. There isn't. It's just like all the other years as people remember those who were fallen. What does this anniversary mean to you?
I think this is really a somber day. Every year is somber, but 20 years, these families have been living with loss. The 9/11 related illnesses are still happening. The foundation needs help more than ever. And first responder families around the country are working nonstop and running into danger for all of us. So I guess for me personally, I'm proud to be president of this foundation and I'm proud of the work we're doing. And we have 100,000 individual donors, which I think is great. If it's a dollar or $5, and we have wonderful corporate partners like Cisco and Allstate and Motorola and on and on. And I think it's about service. What can we do? How can we help the people in our community?
One of the partners I know you have is Mattel. A really fun thing is happening there. They came out with 6 Barbie dolls representing women who were on the front lines. One is a scientist who helped come up with one of the vaccines, the COVID-19 vaccines. And talk to us about how the fund, the foundation, is benefiting from those Barbie dolls.
Mattel reached out to us right after COVID, and they sent Barbie dolls right away. So we were giving Barbie dolls to children of first responders. And what I love about what you just said is that children are playing with first responder women who are basically taking care of the country. So they get to see how important first responders are, nurses. They have a paramedic, I just saw, doctors, right. Scientists. And I think it's a great message for young children that they are wanting their role model through Mattel will be a first responder.
Fantastic. And thank you for all the work you're doing. Jillian Crane, president of the First Responders Children's Foundation. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me here.
And do stay with us. More to come. When we come back, the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, which lost hundreds of employees here on that fateful day, Howard Lutnick, joins me next.
September 11, 2001. I was 2 months on the job at Bloomberg News when the plane first struck the World Trade Towers. My managing editor sent me down there to cover the story as quickly as possible. Colleague and my camera person flew down the FDR. Streets were closed, police everywhere. Somehow managed to talk my way through, and we were able to park by the old NASDAQ, a few blocks away from the towers. We walked towards the towers while people were running away as fast as they can. Moments later, it was pitch black. The tower had came down, and we were running away as fast as possible. It was the scariest moment of my life as I walked from all the way downtown back to my home in Midtown. And for days and months, we covered the story on a daily basis. It hit all of us in New York very, very hard, and all those around the world, something we will never, ever forget.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance, live from the 9/11 Memorial at the World Trade Center site. Of the nearly 3,000 lives that were lost that day, 658 worked for one company, the Wall Street firm Cantor Fitzgerald. It was housed in the upper floors of the North Tower. Chairman and CEO Howard Lutnick survived that day. That morning, he was actually bringing his daughter to school, and he wasn't in the building, but he did go on to rebuild the company and lead the charge and find resilience amid the darkness. And I am so pleased to have Howard Lutnick join me here now remotely. Howard, it's good to see you again. You and I have talked many times over the years on various 9/11 anniversaries, and I'm wondering if on this 20th anniversary, as you reflect back, is there something in particular that sticks out to you? And I'm wondering if this year feels any different than the rest.
What dawned on me this year is, on September 11th, I had worked, I graduated college and went right to work for Cantor Fitzgerald, and it was really the only firm I'd ever worked for. And I had worked there 18 years leading up to September 11th. But now I've worked at the firm longer post September 11th than I did before. And sort of that really struck me as extraordinary that more of my life at Cantor Fitzgerald has been post September 11th than before. And so as I reflected back, it seemed like we've come such a long way. We were about 2,800 people then, and now we're 12,000 people. And now we're hiring the children of people we lost back on September 11th.
That's incredible that you're now bringing on hiring children of employees you lost on 9/11. How do you talk to them about what happened that day, Howard?
Well, when so think about it. You're hiring. You've made an offer to hire the young people of the people who were killed. So that means the widow or the widower has got to be cool with you, because remember, your loved one died working at the firm. And then never underestimate the strong opinions of a 22-year-old. And they might. I always thought that they would have a negative view of the firm, but in fact, we've done so much. We gave those families. We raised $180 million for the families. Paid for 10 years of health care. We made a community of our relationship with those families. And so what we do is we offer them a job, and they come in, we help train them, we teach them, we help them go into different departments they want to work in. And the thing is, like today, when I met with two people today, I just told stories about their dad. One guy, his name is Austin, he's about my size. His dad was much bigger than me and had lots of hair. And I was like, what happened? How come you didn't get your dad's hair? We just keep the memories alive, talk about the relationship, and it's really uplifting and really positive.
And the money that you talked about raising, that's coming from the Cantor Fitzgerald Fund, which I know you set up almost immediately, 3 days after the attacks. I know today is your annual charity day, and you usually have lots of celebrities help you raise funds. How is this year different? And I understand you're raising funds now for victims of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Correct. So every year on the business day, usually it is 9/11, but this year it's obviously 9/11 is on Saturday, so we're doing it today. All of our employees waive their day's pay, and we don't give our profits. We give every dollar of revenue away to about 150 different institutions, and then we do a big disaster relief effort. We've been to Hurricane Harvey in Houston, Hurricane Sandy around New York, Moore, Oklahoma, when they had their tornado. And we'll go in and we'll take care of families who are just devastated by those natural disasters. So today, all my employees waive their day's pay, and we ask our clients to do as much as they can. And in exchange, we donate about $12 million. So we're running a little ahead of last year. Usually we raise between 10 and 11 million, and I make a donation to top us off to 12 million. So I'm excited that we'll be able to take care of so many different organizations this year as well.
That is unbelievable, and we thank you for all the work you continue to do, Howard, year after year. I know that one of the employees you lost that day was your brother, Gary. Tell us, when you think back to your relationship with Gary, do you remember your last exchange with your brother, and how are you keeping his memory alive?
So on Monday night, he took me to the Michael Jackson concert. If you remember, there was a Michael Jackson concert. And he took me to a Japanese restaurant on the Upper West Side. So, I go to this restaurant and I said, why are we on the Upper West Side and not down near Madison Square Garden where we're going to this concert? He goes, because this is a great Japanese restaurant. And Howard, you need to know this restaurant. So that's what he was like. He was trying to show me cool, neat things. And me, my sister, and Gary, we lost our parents when we were young. So my sister, Edie, who runs a release fund, and myself and my brother were really close. And so we were at the night of Monday night, the 10th of September, together, the three of us at the Michael Jackson concert. And then you know, Gary called my sister from the Trade Center and said, you know, he said goodbye to her. He got through to her, and she said, "Oh, thank God you're not there." And he said, "I am there, and I'm going to die, and I love you," and sent his love to me. It was really just incredible that he got through to my sister. But you know, he was a great young man. You know, great passion, great enthusiasm. He liked sunglasses. He liked music and great food. You know, he lived his life, and you know, unfortunately, we lost him at 36 years old.
Incredible courage that he displayed that day in calling your sister as well. And it's so wonderful to see you smile and remember him in that way. You know, Howard, you didn't have to bring Cantor Fitzgerald back. You didn't have to do it in New York City. Tell me why you did. But we do want to know, you didn't do it back here at the World Trade Center site. You're now up in Midtown, actually in an office I used to be at when I worked at Bloomberg. You're in the old Bloomberg offices there. Why did you decide to rebuild Cantor Fitzgerald, and why not do it down here?
So the first thing was we put out a phone number, and we said, look, if you're alive and you work at Cantor Fitzgerald, just call this number. And so we had, you know, we lost 658 out of 960 New York headquarters employees. And they called in. I said, look, we have two choices. We can shut the firm. We're going to go to 20 funerals a day every day for 35 straight days. I mean, it's just pulverizing. Or we're going to work harder than we've ever worked before to rebuild this company. And God knows we don't really want to work. So the idea would be, let's do it to take care of the families of those we lost, because these were our friends' families. You know, people don't give enough credit to the fact of how much they care for the person who sits to their left and to their right. You know, you love these people. You spend more time with the people you work with often than your family members. So, you know, we really, really cared about the people that we lost, and we decided we were going to rebuild this company. We were going to give 25%, not of our profits, but 25%, literally employees gave 25% of their salaries to these families. And we set out to rebuild the company to take care of these families. And we were able to raise them in the first 5 years, $180 million to help them get through this horrible crisis. And we hired people, and here was the most incredible thing. We said to people who were joining, look, you've got to give 25% of your salary to these families. So imagine the people joining Cantor Fitzgerald, right? They join a crushed organization, and then they're going to give 25% to these families. And so the people who join the firm are remarkable. These are amazing people. And that's the shoulders on which we rebuilt this company. So we are uptown, right? We took Bloomberg's old offices from Bloomberg, which was great because they had furniture in it, which we needed. But we've also, you know, so right now I'm at 55 Water Street downtown. We've got offices downtown on 199 Water Street and 55 Water Street. And we've got almost 5,000 people in New York now. So it's a pretty big company, 12,000 people around the world. And, you know, I can't be more proud of the people who work at Cantor Fitzgerald, the BGC partners. These are great people who helped us rebuild this company and help stitch together the ripped apart insides that I had.
Howard, in just in the final seconds I have, you know, 9/11 we know changed the world as we know it. It's changed so many things about our everyday lives. But to your mind, how has it changed Wall Street?
Well, you know, it was the first big push to technology. You know, people had to move out of their offices. It was the first big push, and you're seeing another giant push with the pandemic. So I think technology is becoming an ever bigger push of it. And I think that was the big change on 9/11, is that people understood that they had to get things done in technology because they could lose their offices. And, you know, and that's one of the fundamental changes I think were wrought from September 11th, was technology driving into the business, and then and people knowing they've got to support each other. You know, Wall Street was incredibly generous to us, kind to us. Our clients were kind to us. I mean, we survived because people wanted us to, and that was amazing.
Yep, well said. Howard Lutnick, Chairman and CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, thanks for being with us. Be well.
Thanks very much.
Coming up next, rebuilding the World Trade Center site with the man who documented it with his camera. We're back right after this. On September 11th, 2001, Joe Woolhead grabbed his camera and raced here to Lower Manhattan to capture the events that were unfolding. He went on to become the official photographer of the World Trade Center and co-author of the book Once More to the Sky, The Rebuilding of the World Trade Center. And I am so delighted to have Joe here with us right now. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Alexis.
So, Joe, 20 years ago tomorrow, when thousands of people were fleeing from this space, you came running with your camera. Yep. Why?
I don't know. I still can't answer that question after all these years, but whatever made me do it, I was compelled to be here to photograph this. I knew that when I heard that the first tower had fell, I knew I had to come down and document this. I knew it was history happening right now. Mm-hmm. And it was vitally important at that moment that I'd be here.
I'm sure, I mean, you've been here for about two decades taking photos, so
yes.
Millions of photos. And I'm going to ask you a nearly impossible question to answer, but when you think back to those photographs, is there an image that keeps coming up that just sort of encapsulates for you what happened here?
The photograph from 9/11 that encapsulates that is taken from Liberty and Church, which is just behind us,
right.
100 yards behind us. And it showed all the first responders on that day. It had a firefighter, it had a police officer, and they were starting to go back in to the fires.
Mm.
And in the distance, you could see the fires. And they were so incredible. It was such courage to actually keep on going back in. That's why that photograph encapsulates the day for me, because it has all of the first responders in that photograph.
Who were the heroes for sure that
Absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely.
Now, you have a new book out. It's called Once More to the Sky, and in it are some never-before-seen photos documenting the rebuild of the Freedom Tower, One World Trade Center. What is it like for you to have documented the destruction we saw here 20 years ago and then the rebirth of this space with that building? What has that meant to you personally?
It has, on a personal level, it's been a privilege to work here and to see the rebuilding of this downtown neighborhood. The community has come together as these buildings have rose up into the sky. Over the years, I've seen the resurgence of the downtown area, and it's incredible to see so many people and so many tourists
yeah.
who now flock to the downtown area because it's such a revitalized part of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I love about it, that I knew that even though there had been great destruction on that day, that New Yorkers would come back greater and stronger than ever before, because I saw it on all of the work that they did on the World Trade Center. Every nut and bolt that those guys placed there, they were proud of all of the work that they put into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew just from what was going on in the rebuilding that this place was going to boom in a few years' time. And it has. Even in the midst of a pandemic, it's still regenerating on a daily basis, and it's great to see all the new companies coming down here, like Condé Nast and so many starter companies as well. I love it. I just love it.
And we can tell by your slight accent, you're not a native New Yorker.
No.
You're from Dublin.
I'm from Dublin, yeah.
What does it mean for you, with immigration sort of also at the forefront right now, what is being here in this country mean to you?
This is the land of opportunity, and it always has been. Immigrants come here, and they might be challenged at the beginning, but they can grow, and they can start a family and be part of a neighborhood here. America is a great place to live. We have our problems like anywhere else, but I still believe that the American dream is possible for anyone and everyone in this country.
When you look at One World Trade Center, the Freedom Tower,
yes.
What do you think? Because I have to think you have some sort of a special relationship with this building. It's not just another skyscraper to you.
Yes, I'm amazed at to see this building finally finished after all the hard work that has been put into it. The World Trade Center site is still not done. We still have not dusted off all the tools and put them away. We still have work to do on 5 World Trade Center. But when I look around this site of all the buildings, to see one World Trade Center is somewhat magical. And it's great to see it as a beacon from anywhere around the tri-state neighborhood area. You can see one World Trade Center.
Yes.
And that's just a beacon of hope for everyone.
Most absolutely. Thank you for all the work you've done here and documenting for generations to come. Photographer Joe Woolhead, your work is still not done, as you said, down here.
And thank you, Alexis, for all your great work that you've done over the years.
Thank you. I was actually working at CBS News 20 years ago when the buildings came down. And
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. I saw those. Yeah.
So in many ways, I feel like we've both been documenting what's been going on down here.
Yes, we have.
Yeah, well,
we
Joe,
have.
Listen, best to you, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. This
All
has
right.
been great.
We're going to be back with much more live coverage on the eve of the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks. We're back after this.
So I was on the phone with my brother talking about the crash into the first tower when we see, the whole nation saw it, the second crash into the second tower. I told my brother, my eldest brother, I've got to get to the TV station. And I raced to the TV station and they dispatched me and a photographer to Oberlin, which is just west of Cleveland. Oberlin, a lot of people don't realize this, but it's the largest air traffic control center in the United States. Almost all flights at some point in North America at some point are directed by Oberlin. So we're outside the Oberlin facility just west of Cleveland. We didn't know at the time, but United 93 was above us. And they evacuated the Oberlin Center. And I remember the hundreds of people coming out of the Oberlin Center, and we asked them what's going on. They said, we've been evacuated, but even they didn't know. Just a few people had stayed inside the traffic control center. And then, of course, we learned later that United 93 had turned over Cleveland and then crashed into Shanksville in Pennsylvania. So the TV station sent me there. We grabbed our overnights and we went live from Shanksville.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance. We are live here at the 9/11 Memorial. at the World Trade Center site. And joining me now is Claudio Marini. Claudio, you own the restaurant Da Claudio's, which actually was in Midtown Manhattan at the time of these attacks, but you chose years later to move your restaurant just a few blocks away from this site. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, this is our home. So we had our first apartment down here a few blocks away just a few months before 9/11. We had to stay out of the apartment for 4 months after that. But we never thought about leaving. I mean, this is our place. So it happened that my wife Linda worked in Midtown. That's why I opened a restaurant over there. But our home, our place has always been down here. That's why I opened the Claudio many years later. And in the meantime, I opened Barberini in the Seaport.
Right.
Also.
I know that restaurant.
That we lost to. But you know.
But you lost that for a different reason. That was weather related.
For Superstorm Sandy.
Superstorm Sandy.
Correct.
Yeah. You. So your restaurant has gone through a lot.
Yes.
You survived through the 9/11 rebuild down here in Lower Manhattan.
Very much.
Through Superstorm Sandy, and now with the pandemic. So right now you're just a few blocks away from here on Ann Street. What has business been like down here?
Very hard. Very,
very hard.
You always have to look at that light at the end of the tunnel. We always look at the light getting bigger and bigger. I don't know how fast we will come back. We're coming back like we did many other times. We believe in that. There's no doubt about it. And we wouldn't go anywhere else. This is our home. You know, we also live down here. We always live down here more than 20 years. So we moved around, but always down here.
And you have children. Are they
three.
Teenagers now?
Yes, they're going to college.
Oh,
they
my.
Just start college this year, the twins.
So what did your family think? And you're from Italy.
Yes.
What did your family think when you said, no, we're not leaving this area. You know, we're going to stay and raise the kids here.
Worries, like many other people. Mm-hmm. We saw many other people leaving that time. Mm-hmm. But you know what gave me a lot of strength and hope? I never forget the walls of people on the West Side Highway cheering for the volunteer every single day. That was inspiring. Every single day, cheering. You are our heroes. And volunteers keep coming and coming and coming.
Right.
And we were coming home with the military police to get clothes and things just in order to go up there because there was no power, no nothing. So the people, I mean, really the strong people. I mean, Americans being really inspiring.
For sure. It's inspiring to be down here, and it's a lot more active today, I think, than it usually is. I mean, you're down here a lot, and it's maybe because it is a milestone anniversary. It's the 20th anniversary.
Every year is a milestone. You know, I had a hard time to come down here for many years after the event, but it was really hard to come close by. It's still here. I mean, it's still here. It's very, very painful what we see, what we've been through. I was running that day away from my apartment. It was traumatic.
Tell me about that, because you were a few blocks away, you said?
Just the last, I think it was the last residential building on Greenwich Street.
On right Greenwich here. Street, okay.
And I was home, my wife was working in Midtown, and I heard the first plane, and we and more other people from the building, we went on the roof, because you don't think it's going to come down. So we were all talking about how we're going to go and fix that hole. So once I went back home and waited and looked at the TV, wherever, the first building came down and the building shaked.
Your building shook.
My building shaked, and the power went off, and then we started running down the stairs. Because you didn't know what was safer, on the street, it was chaos.
Of course.
In the building. So we kept running and running until there was no phones, and everybody was looking up because people were saying there are more planes. There was no contact with the media, so only the cars. Right. Yeah, radio.
Right.
So everybody listened to the car's radio. It was crazy.
So your wife was in Midtown?
Yes.
So she must have been frantic.
Absolutely.
Trying to contact you. And were the kids in school that day?
No kids then.
Oh, you didn't have children then?
No, thank God. We met at St. Vincent Hospital, which is not there anymore.
Okay. I know St. Vincent's Hospital.
Exactly.
Sure.
And I never forget. We met there. She's coming down and I'm going up. And all the ambulance coming there. It was terrible.
No.
Absolutely.
And since that day, I mean, you've seen this rebirth down here. How do you feel staying down here after all that and seeing this rebirth? I mean, it's sort of like, I told you so, we'd come back bigger, better, and stronger.
Resiliency, definitely. It's amazing. It just, we also have, you know, we do it also for our kids and for our community. Mm-hmm. We believe in here forever. We know a lot of people, and they help us rebuild too. They deserve a lot of credit because they were there for us always. They always come back. It is amazing. America, it taught me a lot in this case, you know.
Really, well, thank you strong. For coming here and for bringing your delicious food. Don Claudio's, we wish you the best and hope to see you pull through this pandemic. I know your industry has gone through
better times.
An awful lot, for sure. We'll come together in better times over a glass of wine. Claudio Marini, thanks so
thank
much.
You.
Thank
pleasure.
You. You know, just a block away from us here to my left is St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church, the new one. The old one was destroyed on 9/11, but now, two decades later, that church is going through a resurrection of its own.
St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church stood in the shadow of the majestic Twin Towers, a place of prayer and peace for 85 years in Lower Manhattan, was reduced to rubble on September 11, 2001, when the World Trade Center South Tower fell. Thankfully, no one was in the church that day, and just a few sacred items were salvaged, including religious icons, a tattered Bible, a bell, and a candelabra. But out of the ashes came a commitment to rebuild. Construction began on a new church in 2015, just yards away from the original site. But financial troubles halted the project 2 years later, until the nonprofit Friends of St. Nicholas was formed to raise money to save the church.
St. Nicholas National Shrine is the only house of worship at the World Trade Center site. It's slated to open to the public in April of 2022.
Andrew Veniopoulos is project executive for the Friends of St. Nicholas.
This 20th anniversary of 9/11, it's an affirmation of our beliefs. And with the events in Afghanistan, it takes a more profound effect. We will, for the first time on September 10th, light this church, the exterior, for the first time to start the 20th anniversary of 9/11.
This dome that's going to be lit up, it's right above us right now. And I understand that it's made with marble that came from the Parthenon in Athens?
Correct. So what you're looking at above us is a beautiful 40-rib dome. Covering this dome is Pentelic marble. It's in the curtain wall, and it's a glass structure. That in between the curtain wall and the structure, there'll be lights. So from dusk till dawn, this church will illuminate as a beacon on a hill.
Now, it's been quite a journey getting this church opened and finding the funding for it. There have been some delays along the way. Of course, the pandemic didn't help things. What will the final cost of this shrine be, and how were you able to raise the money?
Well, the final cost at the end of the day is $85 million for construction, and we're going to leave another $20 million for an endowment. We want to leave this church in proper financial footing. And as an arch, you know, we have great Greeks around the world, Greek Americans and non-Greeks, that have contributed this. Tens of thousands of people have contributed, whether a dollar, $5, $10 million.
The National Shrine will also include a non-denominational space for people of all religions and backgrounds to pray and reflect.
And just like the old church, where people of all faiths and creeds used to come in there, light a candle, and sit there and just pray to God, or just meditate, you know, just to take a time out from their busy days. We were bringing that essence back to this church on the second floor, and anybody that wants to come here to have that opportunity again.
That's exactly what Anthula Katsimatidis' brother John did frequently when he worked in the World Trade Center's North Tower as a bond trader for Cantor Fitzgerald. John died in the terrorist attacks on 9/11, along with 657 of his colleagues.
St. Nicholas was a tiny little church, and in the middle of, you know, concrete and buildings, and John actually found it. So he would go before work, after work, whenever the little church was open, and light a candle. So for us, the fact that that's opening, it's going to be a wonderful way for us to pay tribute to John and to pray for him in a house of worship.
When the doors of this shrine finally do open, what's the symbolism to the world?
It's an affirmation of religious liberty for people to show that regardless, the truth will always come out of darkness. The light will always come out of darkness.
And my thanks to Andrew Veniopoulos for that inside look at the National Shrine here at the World Trade Center site. Coming up next, I'm going to speak with an attorney who represents over 25,000 people in the 9/11 community who have illnesses related to being near Ground Zero, and they're not all first responders. We're back in a moment. Tomorrow marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and many first responders and others are still battling illnesses, health problems. More than 250 FDNY firefighters alone have died of 9/11-related illnesses. I'm joined now by attorney Michael Barish, managing partner at Barish and McGarry. And Michael, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I know your firm is doing the hard work representing thousands of people, not just first responders, who were impacted by their time being here on the pile or in the area. Tell me what kinds of illnesses they're experiencing now.
Okay, so NIOSH has now linked 68 cancers to the World Trade Center toxins. There's a presumption, even if you're a smoker or have a family history of breast cancer or prostate cancer, if you were exposed to these toxins, the Victim Compensation Fund will give compensation. And more importantly, you're entitled to free health care for the rest of your life from the World Trade Center Health Program. The really heartbreaking thing is we fought so hard to get these bills permanently extended and fully funded. Mm-hmm. Yet so many non-responders, the guys here in Wall Street, the guys at Goldman Sachs, the American Stock Exchange, the New York Mercantile Exchange, New York Stock Exchange, they don't know they are eligible. Mm-hmm. Only 8% of the non-responders have enrolled in the health program, while over 80% of the firefighters and cops have responded. So we need to do a better job of spreading the word that everybody in the financial community is eligible, and they should register now, even if they're healthy.
Good, and we're doing a program like this. We're helping to spread the word. How can people find out more? Where do they need to go?
Well, they can go to 911victims.com. Of course, there's so much information. There's an affidavit you can download. You need to prove that you were here. So if you worked at Goldman Sachs, for instance, it's easy to prove it. The company still exists and will write you an employer verification letter. But let's assume you work at any of the tens of thousands of small companies that are out of business.
Right.
Right? You're not in touch with the former boss. Mm-hmm. You're not in touch with your former co-workers. How are you going to prove you were here? You have to have two affidavits. Well, that's why I'm telling people, even if you're healthy, get those affidavits signed now. Mm. And if you're lucky enough to have your former employer still in business, well, then get an employer verification letter, and you'll upload it to the fund. So this way, God forbid you ever get sick, you're covered. But don't wait until that moment when the doctor says, ma'am, I'm so sorry you have cancer. I mean, not a day goes by without one of my clients dying. We've now lost, the Department of Justice just mentioned it this week, we've now lost 4,500 people to 9/11 illnesses. That's way more than the 2,956 people who died on 9/11.
This victim compensation fund was extended recently to the year 2090.
That's right.
Is it funded through all those decades?
Fully funded, and you're not taking money away from firefighters and cops. That's one of the most common reasons I hear from people who are survivors, not responders. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take money away from others. You're not taking money away from anyone. You're protecting your family. You know, 9/11 did not end on 9/11. I know that the press, no offense, but everybody's out here today because of the 20th anniversary. But on Sunday, people will still get sick. Mm-hmm. And the press probably won't be paying that much attention. So I so appreciate your helping me spread the word, because there are people out there who have the rights. I mean, the free health care alone is invaluable.
Absolutely. So if the fund is good to go through the year 2090, I imagine there is no deadline for when a person can actually bring a claim.
The only deadline is if you die, and then your family supposedly has 2 years from the date of death to register a claim.
Okay.
But there are exceptions. If you didn't know that you were eligible, the special master can say, oh, well, there were extenuating circumstances, and she still may find you eligible. But if you know anybody out there whose loved one passed away in the last 15 years due to a cancer or respiratory illness, it's not too late for them, probably. So register. You know, you don't need a lawyer. I know, isn't that amazing? A lawyer telling you this. But so many people think the 10% fee that Congress set for lawyers is well worth it. Again, take advantage, access what you are owed. That's right. What John Stewart always tells people.
Right, and he was one of the people who really, really fought.
We never would have gotten it passed without him. I made 25 trips to Washington, but it was him shaming Congress that got this thing done.
Yeah, his face was all over the press, absolutely. I know that your office is located not too far from here, and in the weeks following 9/11, the EPA said, the Environmental Protection Agency said, it's okay, you can come down here, the air is okay to breathe. I mean, were they just missing the boat back then?
Look, the fact is, they wanted to reopen Wall Street, and they did. By the EPA coming out 5 days after 9/11, and the EPA czar, Christine Todd Whitman, said the air is safe to breathe, we came back to school. We came back to our homes. My office is two blocks from here. And in the last 15 years, my secretary, Liana, died at age 47 of breast cancer. My paralegal, Dennis, also at 47, died of kidney cancer. I'm a prostate cancer survivor. My other secretary, Barbara, has lymphoma. Two other people in my office have skin cancer. These are all considered related to the toxic dust. And what did we do wrong? All we did wrong was listen to the EPA. We wanted to help the economy and get it going again, but we're paying a price. But the government did the right thing by creating the health program and the victim fund. So that's why John is always saying, access what you're entitled to. There is a scientific proof linking 68 cancers to these toxins.
Unreal.
You don't have to prove anything other than the fact that you were here.
Now we're facing this pandemic. Last year, I know the Victim Compensation Fund was amended to ensure that if a post 9/11 worker died from a COVID-19 related illness, they can somehow still tap the fund?
You're very close.
Okay.
If they had COVID and they had an underlying respiratory condition or cancer that compromised their immune system, then yes, the Victim Compensation Fund will view that as a 9/11 related death. And they're giving significant compensation, $250,000 for the death, another $250,000 for an underlying cancer. And then if you were under 65, they'll give you lost income up to the age of 65. So this could really mean financial security for a family. And that's why it's heartbreaking when I see people when I know there are so many people out there, mostly office workers, who don't realize they are eligible.
Michael Barish, thank you for joining us today and for helping to get the word out. Hopefully people who are hearing this and seeing this will be able to act for themselves or for a loved one or a friend.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Do stay with us because coming up next, we're going to go inside the 9/11 Memorial Museum here right behind me for a look at how it continues to tell the story of what happened here for the next generation.
I remember it was a Tuesday. It was a beautiful Tuesday in September. And I had just finished producing a segment with Tracy Ullman for the Today Show. It was a fun, lighthearted segment. And then after that segment was over, I walked from the studio back over to our offices. And when I walked into the front door, I saw Vivian, who was our PA and front desk receptionist. She was in shock. And I said, "Vivian, what's going on? What's happening?" And that's when I saw the TV. And the first plane had hit the towers. And first I panicked. I called my then boyfriend, who's now my husband, trying to figure out, like, was he okay? Because he worked in the towers. And once I got a hold of him and he was fine and hadn't gotten into the buildings, I ran back across to the studio. And we just, first we were in shock. And then we just kind of instinct kicked in and we started making calls and checking the wires to kind of help support the show that went on for hours that day.
Welcome back. Here we are live at the 9/11 Memorial on the site of the World Trade Center on the eve of the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks. The area around these memorial pools, very active as a lot of folks, tourists and then people who are survivors, or people who lost those in these buildings come back to commemorate. There are a group of gentlemen here to my right, and a number of them were with the NYPD at the time. One of the men there was the chief of the Port Authority when 9/11 happened. They come back every year to commemorate the brothers and sisters they lost. And the chief of the Port Authority told me that he comes back at midnight on 9/11 every year because he likes to come when it is quiet and peaceful, and he likes to remember in his own way. And we've been hearing different stories from folks throughout the day on how they are coming with their own personal stories to remember and to honor the courage that we saw on display here 20 years ago. You know, the National September 11 Memorial and Museum, right behind me here, attracts millions of visitors from around the world every year as it works to ensure that the next generation never forgets.
For almost a quarter of the U.S. population, 9/11 is not a searing memory, but something to be learned about in a museum.
Those images are imprinted in our consciousness, but there's an entire generation of people, 25 years and younger, kids who were maybe too young to remember the events or born after 9/11, for whom this is history.
Dana Hytus traveled from Santa Rosa, California to visit the 9/11 Memorial and Museum in Lower Manhattan. She was just 11 years old on that fateful day.
I remember sitting in class watching it, and it's just always been something that's really stuck out to me, like my first thing in history that I've actually experienced. So this has kind of been something on my bucket list that I've wanted to do, so coming here was really important to me.
The museum typically welcomes about 8,000 visitors a day, but the pandemic has reduced that number to roughly 4,000, denting the museum's budget, which relies on ticket sales to cover 90% of its operating expenses. One of the most visited installations here at the museum is this, the last steel column removed from the ruins of the tower. It's covered with photographs, signatures, and mementos from the recovery crews and families of the victims. And Thula Katsimatidis lost her brother John on that day. She says the passage of time has not eased her pain.
But for someone like me, someone who endured this kind of a loss, 20 years really isn't that long. So when people ask me that question, it's really hard to answer because I feel like I think about John as if I lost him yesterday.
John Katsimatidis worked in the North Tower, where he was a bond trader for Cantor Fitzgerald, the Wall Street firm that lost a staggering 658 employees in the attacks. To help ensure the next generation never forgets, the museum has launched the Never Forget Fund, which raises money to pay for educational programs to teach young people about what happened on that day and its lasting impact on the world. This limited edition commemorative metal ticket is just one of the ways the fund is raising support.
We are encouraging people, give it to that teenager in your house. Give it to that college student. Mm-hmm. Encourage them. Here's your ticket. Learn what happened 20 years ago. Yeah. So it is a way of transmitting the history to the next generation while maintaining our own ability to commemorate.
A museum ticket costs $26, but the 8-acre Memorial Plaza, with its two reflecting pools covering the exact footprints of the original Twin Towers, is free and open year-round. Katsimatidis, who is also a museum trustee, says the space is an affirmation of life.
You know, you have the beautiful canopies of trees and all the beautiful green grass. And of course, it's open to the sky and the sound of the rushing water. Every once in a while, if you could see, we could see a little rainbow, right?
Yeah.
Which, how can that not give you hope, you know? And when we got here, the wind just spit the water up at us, which was awesome because I really felt like that was John sending me a message.
A message of hope and light while remembering one of our country's darkest days.
The 20th anniversary of 9/11 is going to look a lot like prior anniversaries. As usual, we're going to have the reading of the names of the nearly 3,000 victims. They're going to once again be read aloud by family members down here at the memorial, and also a familiar sight The Tower of Light is back. Those two beams of light symbolizing the fallen towers. Also this year, for the second year in a row, bridges and landmarks in and around New York City will also be lit up in memorial blue. And, you know, some people might think because this is a milestone anniversary, the 20th, they should be doing something different or extra special. And Anthula Katsimatidis, who you saw there featured in our package, who lost her brother John here, told me she doesn't need the so-called bells and whistles. She's just so grateful that she can come and gather with fellow family members who lost loved ones here on that day. Remember, they couldn't do that last year because we were in the height of the pandemic. And so she said she's looking forward to coming down here, reflecting and commemorating with a group of people. She said a club she never wanted to be a part of. None of them did. But they now have found themselves like family. Throughout these past two decades as they come every year to commemorate and remember their loved ones. You know, in the 20 years since the September 11th attacks, I have seen Lower Manhattan come back bigger, bolder, busier than ever. All of that, even in the midst of a global pandemic, and all the while staying true to the promise that we must never forget. We're live at the World Trade Center site in Lower Manhattan. I'm Alexis Christophorus. Thanks so much for joining us for this special edition of Yahoo Finance.